Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, I'm Thomas Dinas, the host of the Delicious Legacy podcast. This episode is another one from the archives, and it's all about a brief history of ancient Mesopotamian food. I'll be back again next week with a new episode, a two-part about the history of Irish food with an exciting expert, and then in the following weeks, I will have some episodes about foods of the Aztecs, foods of the Ottoman Empire, foods of the Persian Sassanids, and Athenaeus Dipnosophiste. So, yeah, there are some exciting episodes coming up, and they're all in some production stage or another. So, stay tuned, and I'll be with you very soon with more exciting archaeogastronomical content. Take care. Given birth by the flowing water, tenderly cared for by Ninhuraja. Ninkasi, given birth by the flowing water, having founded your town upon wax, she completed its great walls for you. Ninkasi, having founded your town upon wax, she completed its great walls for you. Your father is Enki, the Lord Nudimud, and your mother is Ninti, the Queen of Abzu. Ninkasi, your father is Enki, the Lord Nudimud, and your mother is Ninti, the Queen of the Abzu. Ninkasi, it is you who handle and dough with a big shovel, mixing in a pit the beer bread and sweet aromatics. Ninkasi, it is you who bake the beer bread in the big oven and put in order the piles of hulled grain. Ninkasi, it is you who water the earth cover malt. The noble dogs guard it, even from the monarchs. Ninkasi, it is you who soak the malt in a jar. The waves rise, the waves fall. Ninkasi, it is you who spread the cooked mash on large reed mats. Coolness overcomes. Ninkasi, it is you who hold with both hands the great sweet wort, brewing it with honey and wine. Ninkasi, the sweet word, you, the sweet word to the vessel. Ninkasi, you place the fermenting vat, which makes a pleasant sound, appropriately on top of a large collector vat. Ninkasi, it is you who pour out the filtered beer of the collector vat. It is like the onrush of the Tigris and Euphrates. This is the Hymn to Ninkasi. This beautiful document dates from 1800 BCE and clearly describes the brewing process in its many phases while singing the praises of Ninkasi, the ancient Sumerian goddess of brewing. It is intriguing that every part of the process has its counterpart in the modern process of beer making. So many of the details ring familiar to a practical brewer's ear. This document was found by archaeologists in the modern region of Iraq, or ancient Mesopotamia, which was a patchwork of different civilizations and people and tribes which lived for millennia from about 6000 BCE in the region which we call Mesopotamia between the rivers Tigris and Euphrates in the modern day Iraq and cheerier. Welcome to another episode of the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Today we're going to talk about the food of the ancient Mesopotamian civilizations. And that basically will cover a relatively big region of the Middle East. And of course it will span thousands and thousands of years into the past. And it will cover different civilizations and peoples who lived in that region. When we talk about Mesopotamia, which is an ancient Greek word for the region of modern-day Iraq and Syria and southeast Turkey. We're talking about the land between the two rivers, and that means Mesopotamia, between the rivers, and the rivers being Tigris and Euphrates. This land was the cradle of civilization. That's where the first big cities were founded. And there was a patchwork of different civilizations, such as the Sumerians, later Assyrians, Akkadians, Babylonians, and so on and so forth. So on our episode today, we're going to try and cover food from a region with many different civilizations, and a region steeped into history with thousands upon thousands of years of history that we can cover and we can learn from. The Sumerian civilization flourished in a region that is generally considered very poor on natural resources. There's virtually no stone and no trees, but there's abundant clay and silt. And this, for the early ancient Sumerians, was enough. They found a way to use it as their main technology. They learned how to take the clay in the ground and make it into pots to store food and drinks. Indeed, they invented the pottery wheel. They used clay to build houses. With abundant reed in the rivers and marshes, they used them as building material for houses and dams, and of course, as styluses. Thank God for the invention of riding. They also invented the plow. The Sumerian civilization is thousands and thousands of years old. First people arrived in the area in the Fertile Crescent about 6,000 BC, so about 8,000 years ago. And from there they started to spread and they worked their way down the rivers of Tigris and Euphrates, where they created the first cities of mankind. And thankfully, with all the technological innovation of canal building and the engineering and mathematics skills, alongside with the growing bureaucracy to accommodate more people and store all this food and distribute it and so on. Thankfully, with all this bureaucracy, they invented writing, which is not only very important for mankind, but very important for us right now, so we can study and understand what these people thought, how they thought, and what actual everyday worries and contracts they had, and of course what foods they ate. And of course in these records we found out also some recipes. So yeah, firstly I want to impress how important it is that they had they invented writing. One of the things that the Sumerians did it was to invent writing, this first writing, it is called cuneiform. As it's obvious, cuneiform is a kind of writing and not a language. So basically cuneiform is used to write Sumerian or Akkadian or Babylonian and so on. And it traces its roots back to the momentous episode for the world around 3200 BCE. So we're talking about more than 5,000 years ago, maybe around 5,500 years ago, when someone came up with the idea of writing. At that moment, prehistory stopped, history began. Cuneiform was invented in Uruk, which is in modern-day Iraq, the southern part of Iraq, and was initially and mainly used as a bookkeeping tool. But luckily, over the centuries and over the thousands of years that elapsed, more and more information was stored in these tablets. And we have, thankfully, we have a lot of details about what food items the king required, what did the priests, the messengers, soldiers, what was exchanged between different traders and bankers, and also what was trading between different regions of the Sumerian loose empire, let's say. Each cuneiform tablet is a time capsule from our point of view. And luckily, many, many survived, as they were made of clay, and they were buried under the temples and the palaces. And of course, a lot of kings had also libraries full of cuneiform tablets, clay cuneiform tablets. And they survived because when this place is destroyed in fires and wars and so on, and destructions, the clay hardened, and of course, the text within it survived. And all these tablets were found by archaeologists buried. The people of the region, as I said, dug canals, and they realized they could grow crops not near the river, but far away from it, as far as they can dig canals. And they became very good at it. That's growing food, wheat and barley. So these first farmers started to spread and worked their way down the rivers of Euphrates and Tigris. Aside from growing wheat and barley, they've noticed that date palms grow in the region, which can nourish them, and also they can be cultivated. And of course, under these date palms, under the shade, other, more sensitive plants can grow. In gardens, they cultivated pomegranates, grapes, figs, leeks, cucumbers, and garlic. They had beer. It was called the noble liquor. In fact, we know that they had at least 13 different varieties brewed directly from the fields of wheat and barley. Mesopotamia is the region that the first beer was made, and it was a very different kind of beverage back then. A more, it wasn't that clear liquid that we know of now. It was more like a very thin porridge. So to drink it, you needed straws, and it was drunk in huge vessels, in huge communal vessels, many people from the same pot drinking with straws. To the modern brewer, the most interesting aspect of these ancient beers is that they were made from bread. As the hymn we heard earlier on makes it clear, the loaves of bread, which are called bapir, were mixed with malted barley to form a mash. And thus, just in some modern breweries, the natural enzymes in the malt would convert other starch sources into sugar, forming a complex, sweet, unfermented wort. Sumerian scholars have discovered that this bread was not only used in brewing, but was also stored in government warehouses on the national highway system. From what we know from texts and from traditions from the region, and also from the understanding of archaeologists, this bread, this bapir bread, had to have been very dry, and it would keep indefinitely. Baking experiments with barley and advice from several sources led to the conclusion that this bread would have been twice baked. It is thought that bapir was seldom baked with the intent of being eaten. Its storage qualities made it a good candidate for an emergency ration in times of scarcity, but its primary use seems to have been beer making. A few years ago, an unexpected discovery has been made, and one that shook things a bit for us ancient food enthusiasts. From the dusty drawers of the brilliant Babylonian collection at Yale University, three cuneiform tablets were exhumed. These tablets, dating from around 1600 BCE, contain about 40 recipes, enough to gain some knowledge at last of the secrets of Mesopotamian cuisine, many centuries, more than a millennia before, than our venerated hero Archestratus. The Yale culinary tablets provide instructions for more than 24 Mesopotamian dishes. Among them, stews of pigeon, lamb, or turnip dish, and a kind of a poultry pie. Written on the best preserved of the tablets are 25 recipes, 21 for meat and 4 for vegetables. Instructions call for the most of the food to be prepared with water and fats, and to simmer for a long time in a covered pot. Most are for meat stews, which suggests that the recipes were designed for the upper classes, as these would be normally the people who could afford meat. According to Jean Bottero, a French Assyriologist, the tablets revealed a cuisine of striking richness, refinement, sophistication and artistry, which is surprising from such an early period. Jean Bottero also wrote, "They seem obsessed with every member of the onion family, and in contrast to our tastes, salt played a rather minor role in their diet." Meats included gazelle, stag, kid, lamb, mutton, squab, and a bird called taru. Frequently mentioned seasonings included onion, garlic, leeks, and stews were often thickened with grains, milk, beer, or animal blood. Two of the main seasonings, called samidu and suhutinu, have not been identified. Most scholars think they're probably part of the onion family. Mesopotamian spices included kamunu, cumin, kisiburu, coriander, ninu, mint, salahu, which is some cress, samaskilu, which is fennel possibly, shambalitu, fenugreek, kaamatu, sumac, surmenu, juniper berries, kasu, wild licorice, and the roots of this probably used to flavor soups and stews with their sweet anise-like flavor. They also had something called siburatu, which is mustard most likely, or it could be roux, and something called ukush hab, which in the amounts specified, which are usually very small, refers probably to minced zest of citron. Other explanations that make little culinary sense is that this refers to cucumber or something similar. Ingredients include andahaxu, which is a wild tulip bulb. There are multiple references to this spring root vegetable. Some statements and comments in the north Mesopotamia. We don't know which species of tulip that refers to, but there are many that are edible and they have a distinct mildly bitter flavor. There's also a possibility that this could refer to a wild crocus or lily bulb. Halazu, which is carob seeds, seems to be another popular ingredient used either as either carob seeds or it could be also carob syrup or carob powder. Carob is widely enjoyed across Western Asia, the Levant, and Eastern Mediterranean today, and imparts a sweet chocolate-like flavor to dishes. Ancient Sumerians ate meat such as sheep and ewes and goats, which we see on texts that they record sheep being sent to kitchens on behalf of the troops, or 10 full-grown goats sent to the kitchen on the behalf of the warriors in the Tumal region. Mutton, pork, fowl and fish were included in the provisions for the king's household, and this is found in multiple texts. Rather surprisingly, we seem to find that meat was also supplied for the prisoners of war. There is a reference for salted and preserved meat. There is something translated as pickled mutton, which was used in a ritual. Bones from sheep, goat, cattle and pigs were found in Tel Amarand, and it was estimated that the bones represent about 14 to 16 individual pigs, 6 sheep and goats, and 415 cattle. Fish-wise, the bulk of the evidence for fish in the diet comes from the 3rd millennium BCE, when large quantities of fish are recorded. There may have been an element of overfishing, which caused the numbers of fish available to drop, making the role of fish as food source less important during the second millennium. Neo-Assyrian reliefs depict the rivers and canals being full of different sorts of fish, which suggests that the fish population may have become plentiful again, but although the texts show the taxes and tribute are being paid in fish, the number recorded are not quite as large as those in the third millennium. Another important ingredient was sour milk, which was included in offerings at the early dynastic legas. Also included in issues are two dishes in which milk formed a major part. These are zliga, a porridge of emmer wheat and milk, and a gruel-like mixture of flour and milk. It is possible that this was similar to the modern Iraqi milk wheat product called kushuk, which is made by mixing dried parboiled wheat grits with yogurt and fermenting it about a week. Kushuk can be sun-dried and ground into powder for storing. It is then reconstituted with water or milk when required for use. Very popular fat for cooking was sheep's tail fat, rendered sheep's tail fat in fact, which is still considered a delicacy, and it was an indispensable ingredient in Iraq until about 1960s. Tuhu is another Mesopotamian meal which uses red beetroots and shares similarities with both the borscht prevalent in Ashkenazi cuisine, as well as a stew prevalent amongst Iraqi Jews called kofta shawandar hamdu, meatballs with sweet and sour beetroots. Likewise, there is a lamb stew, which calls for meat sautéed in sheep tail's fat. A close cousin to the stew might be the Iraqi pasha, a dish which is prepared by cooking all the parts of the sheep, and the sheep carcass is prepared in similar ways as to the ones described in the tablets.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Three of the world's oldest known recipes, recorded 3,700 years ago by an Akkadian scribe, were translated, and I'm going to give you the instructions shortly. These were very brief recipes, shall we say, not mentioning much in terms of quantities. In fact, quantities weren't mentioned at all. And also the ingredients, it was more like a list of ingredients and with very simplified or abbreviated cooking instructions. A lot of them, of the words I'm going to use now, it's basically elaborations that have been added from the translators to enhance the meaning of the original recipes. For kid stew, singe head, legs and tail over flame before putting in pot. Meat, in addition to kid, is needed, preferably mutton to sharpen the flavor. Bring water to boil. Throw in fat. Squeeze onion, samidu, which is another plant probably of the onion family, and garlic, to extract juices and add to pot with blood and sour milk. Add an equal amount of raw suhutinu, which is another plant, probably of the onion family, and serve. Taro bird stew. As I mentioned earlier, taro is a bird that we don't know which exactly, what is translated exactly. So go with a suggestion that it might be a pigeon or quail or a partridge. So the recipe goes like this. Besides the taro birds, meat from a fresh leg of mutton is needed. Boil the water, throw fat in, dress the taro and place in pot. Add coarse salt as needed. Add hard cake of malt. Squeeze onions, samidu, leek, garlic and add to pot along with milk. After cooking and cutting up the taro, plant them to braise in stock from the pot. Then place them back in pot in order to finish cooking. Then must be brought out for carving. Braised turnips. Meat is not needed. Boil water. Throw fat in. Add onion, an unknown plant known used as seasoning, which we cannot decipher which one. Coriander, cumin, and kanashu, which is a legume. Squeeze leek and garlic and spread juice on this. Add onion and mint. For a meat pie baked in an unleavened crust, we have the following instructions. Carefully lay out the fowls on a platter. Spread over them the chopped pieces of gizzard and plaque, as well as the small sepetu breads which have been baked in the oven. Sprinkle the whole with sauce. Cover with a prepared crust and send to the table. Stirred into the dough were various condiments and aromatic ingredients that enhanced the taste. The pie's filling was composed of small fowls. We don't know whether these were wild or domestic fowl, and cooked in a spicy sauce with their own gizzards and plaque. The result must have been like a gravy, a giblet gravy. And when the dish was served, it was garnished with small flatbread loaves that were also flavored. Not too different from the bread stuffing we eat chicken today. Mesopotamian style fowl. Ingredients from the tablet. Pigeon, salt, water, fat, vinegar, semolina, leek, garlic, shallots, tulip bulb, yogurt or sour cream, and greens. As with all Mesopotamian recipes, how these are put together and in what quantities is up to you. So for vinegar, we can use some pomegranate vinegar. So we'll clean and dry the fowl and salt liberally inside and out. We put aside. Prepare water, stock and vinegar in a large stock pot, large enough to hold the birds too. Prepare water, stock and vinegar in a large stock pot. Add butter, asafoetida, mint and rocket, and heat over high flame, stirring occasionally. When the water has come to a boil, add the birds and return to boil. Reduce heat a bit and cook uncovered over medium heat for 5 minutes. Then reduce heat till liquid just bubbles. Cover and cook for 5 minutes. In a food processor, pulse together the onions, leek and 6 to 7 cloves of garlic and some yogurt. Add it to the water and the chickens and continue to cook for another 10 minutes. Don't overcook. Total cooking time for the birds in the pot is 15 to 20 minutes. When done, remove birds from the pot and set aside until cool enough to handle. Preheat the oven to high. While cooling the birds, take the stock you used to cook the hens and pour it into a clean saucepan. If you are using a cup or two of stock to make couscous, barley or some other grain, do it now and pour off about one third to one half of the stock that remains. Heat to a steady low boil, stirring constantly, and cook uncovered to reduce. Pulse the mint and sage with the remaining garlic in the food processor a few times until nicely mixed, and add a teaspoon or two or so of water to moisten them. What type of meals did the people of Mesopotamia prefer or think right? Remains of food dishes were found on saucers as part of a foundation offering on the mid-3rd millennium Ur being a city in the ancient Sumerian region. Here the bones of sheep or goat, date stones, rings of dried apples and the remains of possible flatbread suggest that a mixed diet of meat, fruit and bread was favored. The rations issued to messengers in that period usually included beer, bread, onions and oil, with the occasional addition of fish. The king's meals saw a wide variety of cereal and vegetable-based dishes, with fruits and honey, oils and fish and meat. In accounts listing food given for a marriage ceremony in the old Babylonian period, sheep, bread and beer together with ghee and lines in oil were issued to the groom, his mother and other members of the wedding party. At Nimrud, in the first millennium, what may be remains of a cooked meal included possibly cracked barley, dried grapes and green vegetables. Texts from the same period and the list of provisions for Ashurbanipal's feast show that a wide variety of foodstuffs were favored and that both cereal and vegetable dishes and meat were used. A text from the Neo-Babylonian period gives what may be a recipe and throws some light on the tastes of the people at the time. The recipe records boiling plenty of roasted spices, including mustard, cress, cumin in licorice water, with the addition of cucumber, and then this is cooked until is reduced to a half. This is then strained and stuffed into freshly slaughtered meat. This suggests that highly spiced dishes were eaten, and possibly that dishes of meat stuffed with vegetables were prepared. Of course, these offerings in the royal graves and the marriage ceremony and the king's meals and Ashurbanipal's feast represent special occasions. It is the messenger's rations and the meal found at Nimrud which may give a better idea of everyday food, alongside with some proverbs that might help. One ancient Sumerian proverb says, "Barley flour in the fields is meat and fat." So freely interpreted, this means that barley flour can taste as good as meat and fat. Another one says, "You are pouring off the fat from meat. You are massing the roasted barley." Freely interpreted, the fat should be left with the meat and the roasted barley should be eaten whole. A third proverb refers to the food of the mother of the heroes, being drenched in fat, and even if her food was drenched in honey and ghee, this would not console her for her sons. All this suggests that fatty meat was considered the best, and the fat and oils were a sought-after part of the diet, and they may therefore have been rare. Mesopotamian dishes appear in records of food rituals and upon archaeological artifacts. Mesopotamians not only fed themselves, but also assembled elaborate dishes for the gods. Sweets, which made their way into popular traditions and rituals, incorporated honey and date fruits. Mesopotamian pastry chefs crafted recipes for kulupu, a sweet date-filled cookie, and mersu, a date and pistachio candy. Ancient texts reveal the ancient Mesopotamians offered the kulupu to Sumerian goddess Inanna during the New Year and Spring festivals. From ancient Mesopotamian medical texts, we also have a remedy for hangover, which goes like this. Remedy for hangover. If a man has taken strong wine, and his head is affected, and he forgets his words, and his speech becomes confused, and his mind wanders and his eyes have a set expression, to cure him, take licorice, beans, oleander, and compound them with oil and wine before the approach of the goddess Gula and in the morning before sunrise and before anyone has kissed him. Let him take it and he will recover. We also have a recipe for a remedy for overeating. If a man eats and drinks to his fill and then his stomach cuts him and his insides are affected and swell up and has a colic, he's suffering from mushekinu. To cure him, take cedar bark, juniper bark, sweet reed, myrtle, and oleander. Chop up these substances, add wine, heat the mixture, pour it off, Add honey and refined oil. Let it cool, rub it on his stomach, and pour it on his anus. Babylonian and Assyrian medicine never cut loose from its close association with incantations and magic. So combined with incantations and certain ceremonies that were enacted in order to relieve the patient from the grasp of the demons, these rites led to the actual introduction of medical remedies by the side of what we may call direct sympathetic magic, such as the tying of knots in a cord or placing a little boat made of some material on the waters to symbolize the expected departure of the demon. We have a well-known text of a variety of indirect methods, such as the peeling of an onion and throwing one peel after the other to the fire, to the accompaniment of a formula, emphasizing the hope that as one peel after the other is consumed in the fire and the onion will never take root or blossom again, so the demon might never reappear. Following the symbolical act of the onion, the text proceeds to the enumeration of other materials, such as dates, palm blossoms, bits of sheep and goat skins, wool, and certain kinds of seed, which are similarly thrown to the fire to the accompaniment of appropriate formula, all expressive of the same hope as in the case of the onion. Now these objects are not chosen at haphazard. They represent the materials introduced into the medical texts, either directly as a healing remedies, such as onions, dates, palm blossoms and seeds, or they occur as accessories in medical treatment, such as bits of skin on which poultices and ointments were spread. Similarly, in ritual texts detailing the ceremonies to be performed by the exorciser, a large number of actual medical compounds are introduced, consisting of such substances as milk, butter, honey, wine, oil, meat, salt, dates, flour and various trees, plants, herbs and stones, which enter as ingredients in the direct treatment of disease. Obviously, through experience, it was found that these certain common diseases, such as indigestion, diarrhea, constipation, colds, headaches, and fevers, certain articles of food and certain herbs can be beneficial. So primitive logic concluded that what was good for a man must be bad for the demon. And accordingly, the remedies were attached to these incantations as helpful accessories to the powerful formula and symbolically introduced into the ritual accompanying the direct medical treatment of disease. So what we see is that food and certain food ingredients played an important role in the medicinal cures of the Mesopotamian people. And this is kind of obvious, since through experience they found that certain common diseases were cured by certain articles of food and certain herbs and plants. So the early doctors and priests and magicians concluded that what was good for man must be bad for the demon. So accordingly, these remedies were adjusted to exorcise the demons, alongside, of course, with the direct medical treatment of the disease. All in all, we can say that we have quite sophisticated cuisine from the ancient Mesopotamia, and we have quite a few evidence that culinary traditions have survived to modern-day Iraq, or at least almost to the modern day, which is always nice. Of course, certain things like animal blood used in soups and stews from the ancient Sumerians is obviously prohibited now. But other than that, the main element seem to be very familiar and similar to the peoples throughout this stretch of thousands and thousands of years. The written records that we have, if you think about it, from 3200 BCE, it means we're talking about this was 5,500 years ago, which is scary, really, how far... how far into the past we have information about. In any case, I hope you enjoy this podcast and learn something new about the ancient Mesopotamians and their culinary adventures. As we've seen, the food, medicine, ritual, the gods and the kings were all closely intertwined, and the same foods that they were essential for sustenance, they were also part of ritual offerings to the gods and medicine to heal people, and also precious and prized items for the kings and their feasts. It's really difficult to condense history of 4,000 or 5,000 years and different civilizations and peoples who all lived around the Fertile Crescent to one single episode about Mesopotamia. But I think what we're trying to do here is lightly touch some very basic subjects and obviously check some food ingredients, what vegetables they had, what meat they ate, and through the records, through the clay tablet records from that have been translated by archaeologists and Assyriologists through the last 150 years, we're lucky to have an insight on the way these people thought, these ancient people thought, and of course found out over the years bits about their religion, bits about their medicines, about the fears and about the loves and so on. And of course we have not accurate information, but a lot of knowledge about the diet. And this comes only not only from reading the tablets, but also experimental archaeology and scientific analysis of remains of the jugs and pottery that has been found over the years. The analysis of the remains has enlightened us with more information about the diets of the peoples back then. Of course, the very interesting thing is these few tablets from Yale that have been found and translated recently, relatively recently anyway, they contain, in a sense, recipes, Sumerian recipes. For my Patreon backers, I will upload some modern takes on the ancient recipes with precise ingredients and instructions on how to recreate them. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Take care, and please become a patron on Patreon to support me, and also to get a lot of extra writing and recipes and knowledge about ancient foods. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Goodbye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.